Great. So thank you all for coming. My name is Christopher Thomas. I'm an assistant professor in the law department here at LSE, and I'll just be chairing today. The main event is Raoul and Frank here, so my remarks are just going to be very brief by way of providing a bit of context and introduction. The event today is brought to you by Spectrum, which is the LSE LGBT staff network, but by way of the Human Dignity Trust, who were kind enough to put us in touch with Frank in the first place. So many thanks to them. Now, you could sort of be a bit misled if you look at a lot of the Western media at the moment about the state of LGBT rights in the world. As the celebrations over marriage equality in the US and Ireland and Mexico tend to sort of drown out other issues that could be raised. In places such as Uganda, however, homophobia continues to and seems to be ever on the rise in some ways, and the fight for LGBT rights carries great risks. Famously, 2014 saw the passage of the Anti-Homosexuality Act in Uganda by the Ugandan Parliament, which provided for life imprisonment for the crime of aggravated homosexuality, what could be seen as only a marginal improvement over initial proposals to impose the death penalty. Now, that law was overturned by the Ugandan Constitutional Court last year, but only on procedural rather than substantive grounds. Those big kind of substantive battles have yet to be fought in some ways. There is much more to address than just the Anti-Homosexuality Act. Many of the colonial-era laws criminalising same-sex sexual activity remain on the books. LGBT people have been subjected to arbitrary arrest, to detention, to torture. Suspected homosexuals have had their identities made public by Ugandan newspapers and magazines. In 2012, the government announced its intentions to ban many NGOs for promoting homosexuality. And the opponents of LGBT rights seem extremely well-resourced, in large part thanks to the deep pockets of certain extreme evangelical churches, largely US-based. So all of this makes Frank's contribution all the more extraordinary. Now, Dr. Frank Mugisha is a Ugandan LGBT rights advocate whose work has taken many forms. While at university in 2004, he started Icebreakers Uganda, a support network for LGBT Ugandans coming out to family and friends. And in 2007, he became the executive director of Sexual Minorities Uganda, which abbreviates to SMUG, an umbrella organization which comprises some 18 LGBT rights NGOs. Frank is currently one of the plaintiffs in a case going before a US federal court, which seeks to hold American evangelical pastor Scott Lively accountable for crimes against humanity for his part in promoting the development of the Anti-Homosexuality Act in Uganda. Frank has also been recognised extensively for his contributions, including with honorary doctorates from the University of Ghent and, much more recently, the University of Glasgow, and as well as with a Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award and a Throlf Rapto Memorial Prize for Human Rights on behalf of SMUG. And interviewing him this evening, we're similarly lucky to have Dr. Rahul Rao, who is a senior lecturer in politics at SOAS. Rahul has a law degree from the National Law School of India University and held a Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford, where he read for his DPhil in international relations. He is also the author of Third World Protest, Between Home and the World, and his research interests include international relations, gender and sexuality, as well as critical theory. So today, we're going to have a sort of an interview set up between the two of them. They'll go for about 20 to 30 minutes, depending on how things go, and then we'd like to open it up to the floor for questions. And after that, there'll be a short reception, which we hope we can all carry on the conversation there as well. So without further ado, over to you.
Thanks. Thank you, Chris. And thanks to all of you for coming here despite the tube strike and all the challenges that might have involved. It's a real pleasure to be able to interview Frank before an audience. This is in some ways quite a familiar situation for me because I've been interviewing Frank on and off in different places over the last few years. But usually in his small office in Kampala, a very discreet office that is remarkably easy to reach despite all of the challenges of doing LGBT activism in Uganda today. And each time I've gone to that office, the number of plaques and international awards on the walls has increased, which is, I think, testament to the tremendous achievements that this small but increasingly growing group of LGBT Kuchu activists has achieved in a few short years. So hopefully we can give you a flavor of the work that they're doing and the challenges that they face and the ways in which they've tried to circumvent those challenges over the last few years. But I want to start from right now, actually, and then we can go back a little bit in time. As many of you probably know, the Anti-Homosexuality Act is no longer law as a result of a ruling of the Ugandan Constitutional Court, which struck it down on procedural grounds, on the ground that it lacked the requisite parliamentary quorum when it was passed. But the word on the activist street and on the internet and the mailing lists and the things I follow is that activists are concerned that it could come back at any moment. Is this something you are worried about?
First of all, thank you and good evening, everyone. This is actually the second time me and Raul are having the interview in the same room. We did this about 4 years ago, I think. I appreciate all the support you've given Uganda and the other countries in terms of fighting for LGBT rights. And, of course, thank HDT for always bringing me to the UK to continue doing this work. I would say that there is, like I've been saying, we are in the season in Uganda that I would call an open-end season at the moment. We are having general elections coming up in 2016. And homosexuality is one of a very hot-selling issue in terms of politics. This is something politicians have used to ride on for their own popularity. So it's an open end. The government, private member of parliament, someone interested in running for politics could decide to use this as a tool for elections. So anything could happen.
Museveni has been in power in Uganda for nearly, 30 years now? Mm-hmm. And homosexuality has not actually been an issue for 30 years, right? So how do we explain that puzzle? When did it become an issue and why did it become an issue?
In my experience, I would say that I came out when I was about 14, 15. And if I was 14 now, I wouldn't definitely come out. And that alone explains the change over the years. I would say that we have had, right now, if you talk to someone, to a Ugandan about homosexuality, they would think you're telling them to accept someone who is promoting a Western ideology or someone who is introducing an idea of sexual abuse or violence towards young boys, mostly, or someone who is in Uganda to take away the culture and the values of Uganda. Whereas, at the time I came out and years back, if someone talked about homosexuality, it would be the negative response would be it's an abomination or a sin. So you would see that the language that is in Uganda right now is very new. And if you look at this is language that has been used in other countries, in countries like Russia, countries like Malawi, countries like Nigeria, countries that have had a presence of extreme American Christians.
So in a way you're saying that new sorts of arguments have entered the political discourse around homosexuality, whereas previously people would have said this is a sin, but it might be your own business whether it's a sin. Today increasingly one hears arguments that insist that homosexuality is Western, imported from the West, or that conflated with pedophilia, right? How do you deal with these claims? What do you say in response?
First, I would say it is very difficult because Uganda is very Christian. And Uganda has some of the most friendly people in the world, like loving and caring and, very, very accommodative. But because of being very Christian, they listen a lot more to Christians. So the minds of so many Ugandans is closed towards the issue of homosexuality. And then the anti-gay groups and the media have mostly characterized homosexuality with the sexual act itself. And a country that is very religious and a region that is not very open to talking about sex and sexuality, it becomes very difficult to have a conversation on homosexuality, which so many Ugandans would identify in terms of sexual acts. So for us, trying to sensitize the public and talk to them about this issue, most people, even those that don't mind, would rather be indifferent than engage on the issue, which they think is going to either cause them trouble in their own neighborhoods, with their own families, with their own friends, rather than discuss it publicly. So we've tried, and some of the strategies we've used is work with civil society. Actually, I have a colleague in the room who has worked with us, Melissa, in our civil society. Happy to see you, Melissa. And, you know, working with civil society, because civil society is doing most of the work in HIV/AIDS, you know, providing services in communities. So for us to pick back on their work and go with them as they do this, to also, within the human rights network, introduce an understanding of what really homosexuality is to the general public. That, in some areas, has worked. But you'll see, because of what I talked about, because of this closeness of the community, that even some civil society members are not willing to take on this burden, because they think it's not our issue. Why should I deal with it and get problems? And then, because there's too much involvement of the church in so many things, because even some of the civil society activities are carried out by the church. And then you find someone who is very supportive telling, you know what, if I take on your issue, then I cannot go to church anymore. I will not be able to sit on the church board, or my children will be expelled from the school that is run by the church. So you see that the reference, again, goes back to the church all the time. And what we've done is also take the political hand. And this, again, is much credit to the international community. The international community has responded very positively to Uganda, that has forced the government not to ignore the LGBT community. So because of that, the government has had both private and public engagement on the issue, whereby we've had our president. He has given, I think I'll go into the negative part, but the positive part, he has authored a letter whereby he says in part that homosexuality was here in Uganda. And then he has mentioned in the past homosexuals have a lot of support. And then he has also recently said, you know, this is affecting investment. So in a way, we forced the political hand in the country. And then using the legal avenues, you know, going to court and then challenging the outing and naming of people in newspapers, suing a newspaper, then challenging the law itself in court and working, taking the legal avenues. So we've taken some of those areas. And most recently, talking about the case that we have in the United States where we're suing one of the American evangelicals, something dramatic has happened, that one of the most anti-gay pastor in Uganda who has been peddling all this propaganda on homosexuality has gone quiet because we found out that he's an American citizen and the court spinned him. And because of that, he's no longer tweeting anything homophobic. And it was reported recently in the news that actually he's in hiding because probably he has not even been paying his taxes in the U.S. He's now wanted for more than the homophobia.
This is Martin Sampa.
Yes.
You're talking about?
Yes.
Cool. So, do you sense that the American evangelical voice on this issue has quietened down in Uganda as a result both of your attack on Scott Lively through the courts in the U.S. as well as on Martin Sampa in Uganda?
I actually think it has gone quiet publicly, but you know sometimes when someone is quiet in the public, you have to get worried because they are getting more strategic. And we have former government officials like the former Minister of Ethics and Integrity who has organized with the anti-gay groups, and they have something they call a family coalition that is aimed at fighting homosexuality. So the strategies they are carrying out, we don't know. And whatever they come out with could be more dangerous. But again, recently, the Uganda is going through, which hasn't happened, but this has been a call by civil society and the political groups to do electoral reforms. And these electoral reforms could affect the constitution. That means they have to. There could be law reforms in the country. And the anti-gay groups have already approached the Parliamentary Committee on Legal and Parliamentary Affairs to ask them to amend the constitution and include punishing same-sex relations. So they are also strategizing and organizing, and that could be equally dangerous.
Yeah. Do you have allies in the political system and in the church?
In the political system, yes, we do. We have, when the anti-gay bill was introduced in Parliament, we had four members of Parliament who authored a minority report. And two of them have been very consistent in supporting us, and one of them has been public up to now, Honorable Fox Odoi, who has stood up in Parliament and said, you know, I'll support the LGBT rights, and this is something I need to support. And he has even categorically stated that he doesn't even mind losing his seat because of this, because he believes that this is a cause he should support. And apart from the four, out of the 300, those are the public ones we have. But privately, there are more. I could say about 18 more or 15 more who are supporting privately. And
what does that mean, private support?
Privately.
If it came to a vote.
Yes, they wouldn't vote. They say we wouldn't go to vote. And then they quietly talk to other members of Parliament about this issue. And in the religious, we have one religious leader who has publicly supported us, but he has faced challenges, Bishop Christopher Senyonjo. And also when the bill was first introduced in 2009, personally that was my first area to look into. Can we get religious leaders to support us? And I did try to consult, and I got some few people who came with me to meet the Speaker of Parliament then in 2009, and we expressed our views and our disagreement with the anti-gay bill. But surprisingly, some of the people who appeared with us in the press at that time, they faced challenges, homophobia as well, and some of them withdrew their support or decided to have their support, but rather quietly. And we also have an HIV/AIDS activist, Reverend Canon Gideon Biamgisha, who, you know, express his support, but again also got challenges, and he hasn't withdrawn it, but rather it's now, we don't know his real stand. But the person who has been very supportive consistently has been Bishop Christopher Senyonjo. And the other religious leaders, still, they are quiet about it. They would rather not be public. Mm-hmm. But they are there, and very few. And we've been trying to again lobby them and ask them that, can you at least preach inclusiveness and love for all at the pulpit. Mm.
Yeah. That's very interesting to hear you talk about the way you're engaging with politicians and priests, including those who are not publicly supportive but privately so. You mentioned also courts and the law, and Sexual Minorities Uganda has been incredibly successful by my reckoning in the legal system, in engaging with the legal system. Victor Mukasa won a case against the state of Uganda for harassment and invasion of premises. David Keto, Kasha, and Pepe won a case against Rolling Stone, the tabloid which was publishing names of homosexuals and advocating violence against them. The Constitutional Court, of course, has struck down the Act. By my count, you've lost only one case against the Ethics and Integrity Minister for shutting down a workshop. So what's the secret of that success, in a way? What about that process has helped you? How have you been able to do this?
First, I would say we have very good lawyers. And then we have a background of both practicing lawyers and also academic lawyers that have been supportive to the movement for some time now. And I was speaking to a law student recently, and he told me that it would be very easy to win a case on LGBT rights in Uganda because the constitution of Uganda is very good. And he said the only challenge we have is because of the prejudice, that even some of the judges could be prejudiced because of the religion and the cultures and or the whole propaganda around homosexuality in Uganda. But he said because of we have a very good constitution that from 1995 that, you know, guarantees us much of the freedom that we've been fighting for as Ugandans. So because of that, I think that is one of the reasons we've been able to be successful in court. And then we have, I would say that the judiciary, to some extent, has been independent on the issue of LGBT rights. For instance, in the case of Victor Mukasa versus the state, there wasn't a lot of advocacy around the case. And I remember when the ruling happened, Victor wasn't even in Uganda. And we went and met with the judge, and we were in court, and the judge mentioned that, I'm giving you a Christmas present. It was towards Christmas. So that was a much better Christmas present than the one for the speaker. And you see that there was no, judges in Uganda would uphold the law if there's no political influence. Yeah.
I want to ask you a follow-up question on that. Would you say that the Ugandan constitution is more useful in this process than international human rights?
I would say so, yeah.
So it's important that you are able to go to court and say, our own constitution that we have given to ourselves requires us to do.
So yes, and in most cases we have used the constitution of Uganda.
Okay. Yeah. I want to ask you a converse question, because some people say that a legal victory is all very well, but at the end of the day, this is about social attitudes, and a judge's ruling can't necessarily do the work of changing social attitudes. What would you say to that?
I think that is true. Like, about 2008, I was being harassed by the police, and then my colleagues told me, if you get arrested, all you have to do is make a lot of noise, and then you'll get out. I told them, I think I'll need a good lawyer to get out of jail, then you can make all the noise. Because if you make the noise, I could stay in prison forever. Because the public can influence the judges in Uganda. But also, changing, we can win in court, but changing the mindset of the public is going to take us a very long time. And it's affecting everything. Because like I mentioned at the beginning, that anything could happen in bringing up another anti-gay law because of the public opinion, because the public is constantly asking. Our members of parliament, they say when they got their constituencies, they identify them with corruption and homosexuality. They tell them, what are you doing to fight corruption? And where is the gay law? And they have to explain, there's no bill in parliament, but they have to give that. But the Ugandan public will identify members of parliament with those two things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the act was in force for about 6 months between its passage in February 2014 and the court striking it down in August. Did life change much for people while the act was in force?
It was a very difficult 6 months time for my organization and other organization. And actually, the place where you met me is not where we are anymore. Yeah. We had to move. I think we've moved offices twice since then. And we lost our office, first of all. And it was definitely because of the law, because the landlord clearly said that. And then we were able to document 162 cases in a report that we published during that very time. And most of these cases were not cases of arrest, but it was violations from ordinary Ugandans. Mm. And Uganda has a history of mob justice, not only towards homosexuality and LGBT persons. When Uganda passed the Anti-Pornography Act, many Ugandans called it the miniskirt law. And they were attacking women for wearing short dresses on the streets. So when the anti-gay law was passed, the same things happened. Ugandans took the law into their hands. And some landlords who were even friendly to LGBT persons who they knew would tell them, you know, I can't keep you any longer in my premises because I could be illegal, and then you could create unnecessary attention on my premises. You could get killed in my building. You could get attacked when you're coming home. They didn't want all that attention when they can rent out the place to someone else. So we saw an increase in evictions mostly. And then the newspapers, definitely, they thought this is the time now to expose the criminals. So they were exposing people, publishing them, publishing names and pictures of people. And every time that happens, almost, I would say 80% of someone published the newspaper, they will get problems. Either they will lose friends, either they will be evicted, either they will be harassed on the streets, either they will lose their jobs. So that happened as well, and all that is in the report that we published. It was difficult for my organization, again, because we had to deal with a lot of cases, and then most of us, including myself, I had challenges with my own housing, with my landlord who liked me a lot. I had to move and move to another place and then lose another place and to another place. And you find that, like, in recently, because of being so much engaged on the case that we have in the U.S., I'm understanding that all the things that have been happening is indeed persecution. But you find that Ugandans do not want us to say that this is persecution. Because when you say these things, they're like, oh, no, you're trying to confuse the Western media, you're trying to get attention, you're trying to create all this hyperbole about, you know, homosexuality, which is not happening. But because this is happening because of the media exposing people, it was happening because there was a law in place, it's happening because of the statements from politicians, it's happening because of the religious groups, then that is clearly persecution of a minority group. So we are actually using some of these examples in our case in the United States to show that indeed when there is a law, there's persecution of LGBT persons.
So you mentioned landlords and newspapers. I'm also wondering about healthcare. How does the healthcare system treat LGBT Ugandans? is that another arena of discrimination? Are doctors supportive or not? Are they?
We have, in the recent years, registered progress, especially in the health area. But we still to register more because we still, and our national policies, there's nothing clear about LGBT persons and provision of services. But the government has come out with a mechanism of indirectly supporting the LGBT community, and they have adopted the health angle of men who have sex with men, including them in key affected populations.
The government has done this?
Yes, but and in our opinion, this is mostly because of attracting funding. So you find that if the government is submitting a proposal, the Global Fund, they will include men who have sex with men under the key affected populations. And then the funding will come in, and then we are under the MAPS network, and you find at the end of the day, the only services we're receiving is attending a meeting, probably. But this, for us as activists, is helping us to do advocacy. Because if we know that certain civil society is receiving funding to do this work, then we go and ask them, you have to do the work. You have to do the work with us. So there has been that small stride in the health area. And also when the law was in place, the Ministry of Health, who I met myself during that time, who is now the Prime Minister of Uganda, issued guidelines to health practitioners to not discriminate in service provision. But clearly, in most instances, that's not what is happening. An LGBT person will go to a health worker, and if they open up to them, the health worker will definitely pull out a Bible for you and tell you, are you even religious, before they give you treatment. Mm-hmm. So it's not. The practice is different from what is happening, you know, what the government is trying to do. But in terms of, and then there's this other notion of we do not discriminate. Do you have to disclose? So do you have to go and, because when you talk to health workers, they say, but you see heterosexuals going to tell doctors, you know, I'm heterosexual, so I need treatment. So even gay people go, treatment is access for all. Don't say who you are, and you'll get treatment. Mm. But then we're not getting the right information and the right services.
Sure.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a different question, and this is more about trans politics. In many Western contexts, LGBT movements have not often had very good relations with trans groups and trans politics. trans issues have often not been taken seriously enough, have often been excluded from mainstream LGBT agendas, and sometimes organizing has had to happen separately. One of the things I've been very intrigued by in Uganda is that trans activists play a very prominent role in the LGBT movement, are in leadership roles, in fact. How do you explain this? What place do you think trans politics has in LGBT activism in Uganda?
First, I would say that the trans people or the trans movement has been the backbone of the movement. It was led by the trans initially, and a lot of leadership still is within the trans movement in Uganda at the moment. But the Ugandan community in general stereotypes any trans person as homosexual. So they're driven to the wall. And if you're talking about homosexuality in Uganda, at the back of the Ugandan's mind, they are looking at the person they saw on the street who is trans. So when they see me, they're like, but you don't look gay. I'm like, but how does a gay person look like? So they'll explain to you how a gay person looks like. And the definition in most cases is transgender person. And then you find that even transgender persons who are not gay or lesbian, they are facing the same challenges. They are being discriminated, or they are receiving all these transphobic insults. And yet some of them are not even LGBT. So I think that's the other reason why the trans is really very vibrant in Uganda. And then, unlike other places in Western countries, for us, the movement is a whole. That's why in Uganda, it's LGBTI. We even include the intersex. And our movement has been like that. You don't find that different organizing for gay people, different organizing for trans or lesbian. Actually, I do remember at some point when I just became the executive director of SMAG, the lesbian and trans movement in Uganda was shielding the gay community, because when you go on the radio station or TV and you're a gay man, you receive far more insults than a lesbian person. So they'll tell us, okay, we'll go and do this. You can do the strategic work behind the scene and we'll do the face and everything.
That's really interesting. I'm conscious that the audience will want to ask questions, so maybe before I hand over to that part of the event, one of the big questions an international or a Western audience might have is, what role is there for international support or solidarity? And of course, we know this can take many different forms, but the question I want to put to you is, are there helpful and unhelpful forms of international support? And could you perhaps give us examples of what has worked and what has not worked in terms of international support?
First of all, I would like to say that international support has been really good, mostly the international media. It has played a positive role, and sometimes a negative role, I would say. And the positive role has been that we did not have a lot of good media in Uganda, but some of the positive international media has bounced back in our own media. And then the international community has fully engaged on Uganda. And everyone asks the question, why? I'm like, I also don't know. The international community loves Uganda. It's not bad. But that alone, keeping the discussion up, the dialogue, it's created a lot of visibility in Uganda. And in different avenues, many Ugandans have come out of the closet because of that. And also for a gay man or a lesbian woman living in the rural areas who thinks they are alone, or if there wasn't this visibility, then they would still be very discouraged. And I think that has helped in issues of loneliness and people thinking they are criminals on their own or not understanding their sexuality, to know that, there are other gay people and the international community cares. But on a more different arena, I think political statements from key politicians are not really helpful sometimes. For instance, if you say we're going to cut aid, first of all, which aid are you cutting? Or are you cutting aid or withholding aid? And then the repercussions back home is that we, the gay people, are causing the problems the country is having. That's why money is being stopped. And then we are blamed for all the bad things. And then it looks like the international communities or they are bullying Uganda. And I would like to say that this is not the majority of Ugandans' opinion. But because we have got huge influence of anti-gay groups and politicians who will speak, and when they speak, then it feels like the whole Uganda is speaking. And then they transform this language, and by the time it reaches an ordinary Ugandan, it's totally different. It's distorted and it's different. And the Western media does that as well so much sometimes. You know, a politician says something different related to aid sanctions, and the headline on a newspaper is totally different. And by the time it reaches Uganda, Ugandan politician, it's different. So I think public statements sometimes are not really good. Whereas strategic support, working, and I would like to say working in the context of each country, because we cannot say what works in Uganda will work in Nigeria, will work in Malawi or Kenya. I think it's country by country, working with activists in the country, civil society, and embassies. They are very helpful, working with diplomatic missions, because they know, they live there. They know what happens on a daily basis. Working with them, and then asking, what should we be doing at this moment? What should we be doing now? Should we go loud now? Should we go quiet? Should we impose sanctions? Should we not? Which is very helpful, yeah.
Last quick follow-up, and specifically on this issue of aid. In February 2014, when the act was passed, the World Bank announced that it was indefinitely postponing a $90 million loan to the health budget, which in that year amounted to something like 20% of the health budget. What is the status of that loan, and what was your reaction to that? Where is that situation now?
I don't know if the loan has been given, but what I read in the news is that Uganda says they don't need the loan anymore. So I don't know if it has been given or not. But at that moment, I think it was a desperate time that needed desperate measures. And some of the...
Did they ask you before they did that?
There wasn't direct consultations on doing that. But it was a desperate time that they needed desperate measures. And it was a desperate measure and a gesture. But also I would think that some of the countries, including the World Bank, that took such desperate measures were to their own values. You know, if the values of the World Bank is that we're not going to support a country with such a legislation, then Uganda cannot force them to give them the money because they have a legislation that is like that. Because I know there were sanctions on South Africa for apartheid. There have been sanctions on other countries that have the death penalty or abuse women's rights. So I don't see any reason why you can distinguish Uganda for World Bank holding aid or some other country coming up with a sanction for their own values. Mm. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both Frank and Raoul for a very illuminating discussion. We have about 20 minutes now for questions from the floor. We have a roving microphone that we're recording. So we maybe just start with this lady over here.
Hi, Frank. It's nice to see you. Long time no see. I have a quick comment and a question, and I might have to run out, so I apologize for being that rude. But the comment is just that it's interesting in the history of all of this how much the role of feminist activists in Uganda and the broader African region is often not noted. It was central, actually pivotal, and in the mid-2000s in particular, feminist activists and organizations were hosting a lot of the LGBT groups. The African Feminist Forum, Uganda Feminist Forum, and other regional bodies have provided a lot of the intellectual analysis, media support, legal support, people like Sylvia Tamale, you know, at the university. So actually we're some of the first base of allies before HIV/AIDS activists came in. So it's interesting that tends to not get acknowledged. And I just wanted to note it because it's actually important in understanding some of the dynamics. And the other thing is actually the role of sex worker movements. And how in Uganda, partly because of also the moral framing, sex worker movements have also very much been allies too. And I think that's a beautiful thing about the Ugandan example, that intersex activists, feminists, you know, I mean, it's been a broad array of people who've been involved. And I think that's an interesting model. So my question is actually about now how you're feeling the African regional support, and if you're seeing the African Commission, the AU, but also the East African bodies, if they're playing a neutral role, if they're playing a positive role, or if you're seeing them standing back or even playing a negative role in terms of the politics and what's happening now.
Thank you so much, and good to see you again. So, of course, first on your comment, I think it's good that you mention the feminist groups and the women's groups in Uganda, because they were very instrumental in supporting us at even before the anti-gay law came up, and even I think strategically supporting us in mobilizing forces and the sex work groups. And I think when I talk about regional support in the country, it's mostly women's groups and feminist groups that really push for this so much. In terms of regional support, there has been, of course, the African Commission recently has a resolution on a resolution that was passed the first time. And again, there has been involvement from activists who have been pushing for this for a very long time, and having a resolution for the first time has been really good. But in terms of the East Africa and the other, we are not seeing a lot coming out of there. And it's a bit of a disappointment that we are not seeing so much coming out of there. But as we're trying to rebuild the International Gay and Lesbian Association in Africa, so probably that with the coalition of African lesbians and other regional groups in the region will maybe strongly push for that, because we think having an African voice that is very vibrant will maybe create a much better force. That will, because if you see in Uganda, the way we're able to defeat the anti-gay law was because we had a very, very strong regional, rather national push, that the government could not simply say, this is a Western agenda. But then our international partners will say, but then you have a coalition in Uganda. You have real Ugandans saying they don't want this. So if we get Africans starting to speak out more, then I think we shall be towards dealing with the situation.
Another question further up the back there, and we'll come down to the front.
Okay, shall I go now? I've got the microphone here. Okay, thanks for that, Frank. It's very thought-provoking, those ideas. I was wondering, with regard to young people, I was wondering how best they might be supported to articulate, to voice their own thoughts and feelings about sexuality and same-sex sexuality. Is there a way of... What's the best way of supporting young people, do you think?
The challenge we have in Uganda is, again, with society. Because young people... Uganda actually has one of... I think the African region has the biggest percentage of young people. But the challenge is, again, with society. That you have this very conservative society, and young people... They already have so many challenges to deal with, unemployment and all that. So involving themselves on the issue of homosexuality becomes a big problem. And then most of them are still picking up these conservative views. But I would like to say that even the stride we've made now, the progress we're seeing is because we have a young population. And I would say that some of them are indifferent to some of these issues. They're indifferent to these anti-gay issues. But the thing is, the avenue of speaking out is still very limited. Yeah.
Hi. As I'm sure you know, it was London Pride a couple of weeks ago. And by my count, there were more supermarkets, global corporations, tax-avoiding coffee shops marching than there were political groups, activists and trade unions. I just wondered what you make of the corporatisation of Pride in the West, and also a point that Chris touched on earlier, which is the kind of commodification of LGBT equality in the West, and whether or not you're feeling the reverberations of that in Uganda.
I don't know how to comment on that, especially on... I because I understand each the movements in different countries. They respond according to, you know, what is happening in their constituencies. And because we've had countries pushing for equality, marriage equality, which were not even asking for in Uganda. And so the difference is really huge. But I'd like to say, first of all, as a gay man, I'm happy to see corporations and multinationals publicly involved in Pride. But then, I don't know the rhetoric on commercializing Pride, you know. But on a politically, like for Uganda, I would like to see corporations involved, because corporations are hiring people. Corporations are paying taxes to the government. So if maybe they get involved more, then they could stop all this criminalization of homosexuality, because then the governments will feel that the taxpayers are talking about this. Investors are talking about this. It's going to affect investment. And my own president has been very clear on that. He's told Ugandans that we can talk about our own sovereignty, we can talk about our values, but you cannot tell someone where to invest their money. And if we continue criminalizing homosexuality, then we could lose investors. So on that level, I totally want corporations to get involved in the struggle. And yeah.
Thank you. I was just wondering, with Uganda's elections, whether there's any prospect of out people standing for public office at any level, or if there isn't, if you think it's a good or bad idea.
This has happened in Kenya, right?
Yeah. Someone stood up. I think it's a very good idea. I've got two of my colleagues who have said they are going to stand. I don't know if they are going to stand or if they will still stand. But it would be a good idea. Very good idea. But in my opinion, I think it would be very difficult to win the election because of the public opinion. And then I also think it would be really very brave, because it would be dangerous, especially doing the campaigns, because you're going to do a campaign in a public rally where you have all these aggressive, homophobic people who are definitely going to be very aggressive towards the candidate. So it would be very brave for someone who is out stand and run, especially in this during this time. But it would be really good. Or if someone succeeded as a member of parliament and then came out, that would be even better. Yeah.
Yeah, hello, Frank. My name is Isaac. I'm sure you know me from Out and Proud. I think maybe because I was late, but I'm sure we at Out and Proud, we have also done our bit to make the president change, because every time he comes here, we do reorganize through our LGBT members like Peter Tacho and other LGBT groups to make all the world know that there are black gays from Africa, from Uganda, who are gay in this country. We do make our voice heard and all of our voices for you. We left in Africa. So last year, we made two protest when he came here in May and in October, and he was successful to write to the Home Office to stop the Speaker, Rebecca Kadaga, coming, hosting a conference here. And when Bishop Chiganda came this year in March, we were there, we protested. And when Simon Peter wanted to come here, we were there, we protested. And when the President of Uganda went on a UN summit in US, he was denied entry in three hotels. So when he came back to Uganda, he hired people to improve his image. This is because of us. So I'm sure every time you are in problem, we go to the embassies, we make the world know what's happening in Uganda. So I'm sure we also do a lot. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and we appreciate the support. And I think it's very hopeful that also politicians know that the implications of whatever they do back home, they will not get a red carpet when they travel outside of the country. So that, especially the issue of the president being denied accommodation in the U.S., because he clearly knows that this is not government-driven, it's not politically driven, it's individuals saying, we cannot accommodate you, simply it's our premises, and we cannot accommodate you. And I think the Speaker of Parliament does understand that, and government officials do understand that by having political statements, it could have repercussions for them when they travel abroad.
Hi, Frank. My name's Andrew. I'm a student here at LSE. Thanks very much for your comments and talking to us today. I noticed that in your comments you said that in Uganda the term MSM, which stands for men who have sex with men, is now being used in Uganda through the public health work of the Global Fund. I'm interested to know if you think that this sort of terminology, which focuses exclusively on the sexual act rather than any sort of sexual identity or personality, is useful for your organisation's work in fighting homophobia, or does it make it more challenging or something else?
First, I would say that it's two-way, because whenever there is a government initiative, or if there's any initiative that includes LGBT persons, we use that as an entry point for our advocacy. But on the long term, it's not, because first of all, it's not inclusive. It doesn't include every LGBT person. And not everyone is going to identify as MSM or men who have sex with men. And then it's totally defining LGBT sexual orientation as only sexual acts. So it's not good for us in the long term. But on the other side, we use it for advocacy. Yeah.
Hello, Mr. Mugisha. Thanks for your talk. I'm a Ugandan living here. I'm really impressed with the information that you have passed to me, because me, I'm not lesbian, but I've learned a lot about what is happening in my country. Now I'm a bit scared. I'm planning a tour to go with my friends. Some of them belong to the group that people do not want to see in Uganda. So would you, now that I've got the golden chance of talking to a person who's really from the soil, I take long to go to Uganda. Are there places that you would say, please do not go to that place?
Like I mentioned earlier, Ugandans are very friendly, and you're from Uganda, you'd know that, yep. And very welcoming. And I think part of the reason we have all this homophobia is because we've been very friendly to the extreme Christian groups. So we welcome them, give them a red carpet. But I wouldn't say that there's a place you can't go, and now we have there's no law on homosexuality in Uganda. There is no law that will criminalize any person, but we have a law that is criminalizing same-sex acts. So that could, if someone is convicted, they could go to prison for life. We still have that law. And then we have got a challenge with, because of the dialogue and this propaganda from anti-gay groups, they so much identifying transgender people with homosexuality. So the community or the neighborhood where someone is living could easily call the police on someone who is perceived to be gay. And then we also have another problem that we're seeing in some of the cases we've covered, is that especially Caucasian male people, if they live alone and they're not in the company of females, then people suspect them to be homosexuals and they call the police. And I wouldn't say that it will happen. It would happen. It may happen or not happen. We've had cases where it has happened. But cases where we've had people come and live in Uganda, enjoy their life, and nothing happens. And we've had people who have come to Uganda for 1 week, and the next day they're in prison. So you just have to be careful. And the biggest problem is what the police is calling whistleblowers. And is that when they identify, when the people suspect you to be a homosexual person, they call the police right away. And the police will not hesitate, they'll just come, arrest the person, parade you before the media, carry out all these degrading anal examinations, force you to undergo an HIV/AIDS test, and then, and the person, you can't go back to your community or where you're renting. And this has happened to, I have an example of a Belgium national who traveled to Uganda, and when he came, he rented an apartment, and the neighbors noticed he was living alone. So they told the police, we have a homosexual in our neighborhood. Police was like, how do you know? Because he lives alone and he's white. He's a Caucasian male. And so the police told them that if you see a male person come in the house, tell us. And 2 weeks later, he got a visitor from Kenya. And the neighbors told the police he has a male person who has come with a bag. And the police said, if you see the person stay until 6 p.m., tell us. And I said, oh, 6 p.m. and the person is still in the house. I said, okay. If the person stays until midnight, 10, tell us. 10 p.m., the police came to the premises, knocked on the house, forced themselves inside, arrested the person, and the next day they invaded one of our mainstream television, NTV, and they were on TV. And, of course, when my colleagues watched it, they told me, Frank, did you see this? I'm like, yeah. And the next day we were at the police station. When you got there, there was a doctor ready to carry out the annual examination, and we told them you shouldn't accept this. And the police was convincing them, and these are people we didn't know who they are. We're just intervening. They didn't trust us because they did not know who we are. They were all foreigners, first of all, especially the Kenyan person was really scared. And they were like, so we have to do the tests because the police say if we don't do the test, they will keep us here. And we didn't have sex, so let's do the test. It's okay. Like, it's so degrading, you shouldn't do it. And then I told the Belgium national, say you're a diplomat. And they said, I'm a diplomat. And so the doctor said, okay, I can't do this now if you're a diplomat. And we drove to the house. We drove to the police with them. I went on the police car with the police, went to their house because the police wanted to collect more information with the lawyer to see if they are gay. And we went to their house. They had DVDs of Sex and the City. And the police had a pile of them and said, okay, come and we watch this. If we find there anything on homosexuality, then we'll know they are homosexuals. But when two days when they were let go because there were no evidence, the landlord said, you can't come back on my premises because they were on TV. And the Kenyan person who was visiting for a week had to leave right away, said, I can't stand this, I have to leave. So it depends, really. You can't know. And there are some visitors we've had who have stayed in Uganda. We have an underground gay bar that happens every Sunday that they have gone to and had fun. They hang out with us, and they've had no problem. But there are people who have come. We have a British national who was there, again, visiting his friend or partner who was arrested and later deported. So it depends, I think. I would say on your luck.
Thank you. I'm afraid we are going to have to draw this segment of the evening to a close soon. So we just take the last couple of questions collectively and then maybe a couple of final comments from Frank, whatever you wish to say. So I'll start with you.
And then you. Hi, Frank. Sorry if this was covered. I came in a bit late. But I've been monitoring developments in Kenya. And so I'm wondering, because I know that trans-border, we influence each other quite a lot, Uganda and Kenya. So while Uganda has made headway, I think, in terms of encouraging dialogue around rights of LGBTIs, and this is thanks to SMAG and other organizations, I think that Kenya is just starting. In fact, each time I listen and watch the news and what's coming out of Kenya, I'm thinking, okay, this is just a repeat of a chapter that Uganda went through. Are there any concerted efforts from the Ugandan LGBTI rights activists to work together systematically with the Kenyan activists in sort of pushing back with the increasing homophobia? Because I feel that if we don't, what the gains that have been made in Uganda could be lost by the homophobia that's building in Kenya. So I wonder whether you can speak to that. Thanks.
Thanks for coming, Frank. My name is John. You mentioned that when Western countries threaten to withdraw international aids of various forms, that often LGBT Ugandans get blamed for that, and that can be very problematic. So my question to you would be, what message, given that Ugandan, the the movement in Uganda has received very significant press coverage and is very sympathetic in the media here. What sort of message would you want to come from our governments, and what sort of particular aid or action would you prefer us to go to our elected representatives and ask them to carry out in order to best aid you in your movements within Uganda?
You mentioned that this is largely a cultural societal problem, and you've obviously referenced the importance of religion and also politics. You mentioned how useful it would be if there were to be, for example, an out politician. Are there other cultural levers outside of politics and religion as have played an important role, I think, in broadening acceptance in many other countries? Are there other cultural levers which could be sort of pulled that would be as or more influential than the two channels you've mentioned? And there's probably not time, but I'd be curious to hear more about the lawsuit in the U.S. as well and how that's going.
Thank you. Hello, Frank, Edwin. First of all, I would like to thank you for leading the movement. You really inspire us to do what we're doing. Thank you so much. The question I would like to ask is, a couple of weeks ago, we went to Birmingham Pride, and we marched. But in Uganda, it was perceived badly, I think you remember. So the question is, what do you think is the role of social media in promoting homophobia and challenging homophobia? Thank you so much.
Okay, should I?
Yes, please.
Okay. Thank you so much. On the issue of solidarity and united efforts, we are working on that because I think each country has been facing different challenges. And like I've always mentioned, that Uganda might be in the limelight, but it's not the worst country in Africa. There are worst countries. There's Ethiopia, there's Tanzania, there's northern Nigeria, and also there are places where you don't even have any kind of organizing like we do in Uganda. So I think a united effort is very good. And then also adopting models like we did in Uganda, for instance, working with the feminist groups, women's groups, HIV/AIDS groups to try and combat homophobia, and also sex work groups. You find that in other countries, these groups are all working independently. So exchanging the ideas is one of the areas we're looking at in coming up with a united front. And like I mentioned, we're trying to re-establish the International Gay and Lesbian Association in Africa, PIE, so that it can bring this united front of the LGBT movement in Africa. And we have been trying to do an East African sort of like a network, but this is through the health angle. And also the other challenge we're having is that the background of LGBT groups is a background of a lot of discrimination and dealing with so many issues. So organizing a network is very, very complicated, and it's very vulnerable. So it takes a lot of thinking and strategizing. But that said, we still at least my organization is in collaboration with most of the major LGBT groups in the region. And so we do a lot of networking with Kenya. And when this is coming up, there's a lot of consultations. How did you do this? And how did you do this? And exchanges. And then there's a donor group that was formed as a basket funding for East African groups called WOHAI. And this has been another avenue. They have a conference that comes up every once a year, and this has been also another avenue of engagement. Actually, the initial idea of forming the coalition in Uganda came out of that donor meeting. So it's that kind of organizing. But I wouldn't say it's very ad hoc, but it's something we're working on. And then also the Coalition of African Lesbians is helping us try to come up with this kind of African solidarity. And then the other part is in terms of aid. Like I've mentioned, it's not helpful for someone to come and say we are cutting aid, because we want to know which aid, first of all. And I've mentioned what is helpful. Statements. Articulate clearly your own values. And don't talk down to these African countries as if they're small countries. Level-headed speeches that articulate values. The American ambassador, when the law was passed in Uganda, he was on BBC, and he was very clear on the support, the partnership with the United States government with Uganda, the American values, and he said, we shall not stop supporting, you know, treatment for people on ARVs, but we shall definitely not support corrupt officials. We shall definitely not support violators of human rights. That kind of messaging that includes general human rights and not distinguishing only homosexuality. And then, you know, showing the country that if we're in partnership with you, we also have our values. If we're giving you money, we have our values of promoting human rights. And this should come, our money should come with these values. And then on the issue of culture, we haven't been very successful there. We don't have culture leaders. And then, like I said, the issue of sex is difficult to talk about. Homosexuality has been associated with sexual practices. So going into the culture avenue is very difficult. But what we're trying to do, in fact, I am spearheading a campaign on football versus homophobia. And this is a global campaign. The Scandinavian countries, especially Norway, has picked it on, and they've really been very good in getting footballers to talk about homosexuality. Because Uganda has a very good culture of loving football. And not only Uganda, even other countries. So if you get footballers, like role models of ordinary Ugandans, talking about non-discrimination, talking about homophobia, then I am very sure there are ordinary people who are going to respond to this. Then we're trying to get involved in charity activities that other people are engaged in, and then getting entertainers as well, because entertainers, they will also speak directly to the mindset of an ordinary person. So we think culturally that entertainers, sports people, and then what we need the most is religious leaders preaching from the pulpit inclusiveness and love, which is a bit difficult, but we're trying now with the sports and the entertainers. And then finally, I don't remember the question on the law, though. But finally, the question on social media. Social media, on the positive part, has played a very, very, very big role in our movement. Because, you know, something happens, you tweet about it, and the whole world knows it. I mean, I tweet something and it becomes news in some of the biggest mainstream media, like the New York Times. And that in a way, has helped build our movement. But also, it has created homophobia, because some of the homophobia that we're seeing in Uganda is from social media. But the percentage of Ugandans that use social media is really very small. Unless something has gone viral, then it will end up on other applications like WhatsApp, and then from WhatsApp it will go into the newspapers, and of course from the newspapers to the biggest media, that is the radios. But if something is on radio, then it will definitely reach majority of the Ugandans, because that is the major area of news in Uganda. And the anti-gay groups, they have that platform more than we do. So our influence on social media is mainly, again, to the section of Ugandans, that's a very, very small percentage, that can access internet, that have maybe smartphones, and that is mainly in the urban areas or semi-urban areas, and of course the international community. And the same to even homophobia. Some of the homophobic views that have been expressed on social media have stopped there. And then something positive is that most of the people who use social media are more progressive. So the homophobic people will post all the homophobic views on social media, and then some of the people are fed up. There has been that fatigue of reading issues on homosexuality all the time. For instance, if you out people on Facebook, some people won't see that as big news. If you publish, if a homophobic journalist tweets about something homophobic, it may not attract a lot of attention because there has been that fatigue of the same people talking about the same thing. You know, Pastor Sempa, before he went quiet, he was tweeting me, tweeting my colleagues. But you'd see that if that had happened 5-6 years ago, that would be news. Pastor Martin Sempa tweeting with me and tweeting with another person his homophobic views, it would make news. But right now, there are people who will see it and ignore it because there has been that fatigue of seeing the same thing. But if it was on radio, the impact would be huge because that would create violence, that would be built on by the larger community. But on social media, I would say it's rather a bit balanced, both the homophobia and the progressive.
Okay, thank you. I think we're going to have to end it there. But thank you so much, Frank, for your insights and all of your work. It's been really rewarding, I think, for everyone in the room. We are going to be able to continue this at a reception just outside, so it's just a few steps out the door, and there's food and drink, and you can continue the discussion there. And thanks also to Rahul for conducting the interview tonight.